first poet tonight, Alison Funk, has lived in this area for, what is it, about three years, 5 years. Well, it's, time goes fast when you're enjoying yourself. We're really happy to have her on the program tonight. In a way, it's a preview celebration of a book of hers, which will be coming out next month, called Living at the Epicenter, which is her second collection of poems. Living at the Epicenter won the Samuel Morse Prize for Poetry from Northeastern University Press, who is the publisher. There will be a official book party November 17th at Left Bank Books across the street, so keep your eye peeled for that. And you'll be able to get the book, which I hope you'll hear a few poems from tonight. Her first book, Forms of Conversion, was published in 1986 by Alice James Books. She has published widely in many magazines. These include Poetry, Antaeus, The Iowa Review, Poetry Northwest, and Drum Voices Review. Her work also appeared in Best American Poetry 1994, an edition that was edited by the poet A.R. Ammons. She is currently teaching across the river at SIU Edwardsville, where she teaches creative writing and other courses. So please welcome, her first time reading at Duff's, Alison Funk.
Can people hear me in the back? Yeah? I'm never quite sure how close to get to these microphones. Okay. I'm going to start off tonight by reading from a long poem in progress. The speaker in this poem is the painter Vanessa Bell, who is the sister of the English novelist Virginia Woolf. And Vanessa Bell was an important painter in the 1920s and 30s, and then lost popularity in England. But for a while, she was really well recognized, never, though, as much as her famous sister, Virginia. The poem begins just after Virginia Woolf's death by suicide in March 1941, and Vanessa Bell was 61 years old at that time. And as I imagine, the poem continues for 20 years and ends shortly before Vanessa's death in 1961. So tonight I'm going to be reading five of the early sections of the poem, and I'm going to have to sort of talk it through because there'll be material between that I'm not going to be reading, so I'll sort of narrate here. The working title for this poem is Day and Night, which is after Virginia Woolf's novel of the same name, and this novel was dedicated to her sister, Vanessa Stephen Bell. They were both Stephen before they married. And the main character in the novel is Catherine Hilberry, who was modeled upon Vanessa Bell. My poem begins with an epigraph from the novel which describes Catherine Vanessa. So I'm going to read that epigraph first. She was inclined to be silent. She shrank from expressing herself, even in talk, let alone in writing. Ordering meals, directing servants, paying bills, and so contriving that every clock ticked more or less accurately in time, was supposed to be a natural endowment of hers. And indeed, Mrs. Hilberry often observed that it was poetry the wrong side out. I'm going to read the first section of the poem now. I have to check my notes here to tell you all the things I need to explain to you. A couple things. I refer to Furl and Rod Mill in the poem, and both of the sisters, when they weren't living in London, lived in houses in Sussex, England. And Furl was the place where Vanessa Bell lived, in a house called Charleston. These houses had names. And I don't know how many of you read, there was an article, I think it was in the spring, late spring, in the New Yorker, which looked at Vanessa Bell and the Bloomsbury group and those people who came to Charleston often, and their wonderful pictures of this sort of museum house that exists there now that I've visited. But anyway, Vanessa lived in Furl, and her sister lived in Rod Mill, which was about 5 miles from there. And I also refer to Leonard at the end of this section, and it's Leonard Wolfe, Virginia Woolf's husband. The sections of the poem are dated. This is April 5th, 1941. Sweet honeybee, she called me, Catherine Hilberry, the saint. Never, I dare say, Vanessa. Beloved, her letters began, all but addressing me, mother. The golden bowl she imagined could brim and brim without spilling over. And now I am calling her by any name that might raise her from the river she left us for, saying, teach me the wiles of metaphor, the sister who had no use for a story before. April, rain soaks the downs from Furl to Rod Mill. So little petrol, the buses in wartime hours apart. Leonard is unreachable in his grief. I imagine that Virginia Woolf's death brought her sister back to all the other deaths that she had suffered, and there were many of them, if you know the story of these people's lives. Vanessa and Virginia Woolf's mother died when Vanessa was 15, and her half-sister Stella died 2 years later, and their brother Toby died several years after that, and then, worst of all, I think, for Vanessa Bell, her son Julian died of wounds that were suffered during the Spanish Civil War. And so I imagine that that the death of Virginia Woolf, for her, really brings back all the other deaths that Vanessa has suffered. Vanessa, as Virginia writes of Catherine Hilberry in her novel, had some natural antipathy to the process of self-examination. This was part of Vanessa's character. Obviously, Virginia Woolf didn't suffer from the same problem, constantly examining. They were very different from one another in many ways, and also similar. I think that for Vanessa Bell, to simplify, probably this propensity not to look deeply at her life was a way of surviving what seemed probably very much too painful to face. But Virginia's death, as I imagine, brings about a need in Vanessa to get past her painterly surface, and to look very closely at her past, to look at herself, to think about her art and those people that she's loved. And I'm going to read the third section of the poem in which Vanessa is really confronting the grief that she's feeling about Virginia's death. And at the same time, she seems to begin, I think, in this section, this painful process of self-examination, of introspection, in what for her, in a sense, is a new medium, which is language. And Virginia Woolf, some of you probably know, once said that had her father not died when he did, that she probably would not have become a writer. And so I imagine that something similar happens for Vanessa, that when Virginia dies, that the sister who was brilliant with language, that somehow Vanessa is then liberated to begin to express herself, no longer in the shadow of her sister. In this section, the very end of the section, I imagine that Virginia seems to speak directly to Vanessa. July 14th, 1941. I am wading through masses of currents, stripping them into bottles. Now I must three more, and the bushes are laden. Is it this that one must get through color? Current red, Goya, blood underlying vermilion. A painter starting over scrapes off layer after layer. How small the berry becomes under the knife, how still. Inside, near the tart center, where the eye no longer serves, where my tongue is a liar, I find her. It's a shudder of mind that seizes the globe, swallows it whole. In the next two sections of the poem that I'm going to read to you, Vanessa is recalling her childhood, and these are more narrative than the section that I just read. And she, in the first section, she's going to be really recalling the rivalry that she felt for her sister, the sense of competition. And in the second section, she's exploring the very difficult relationship that she had with her father, Leslie Stephen, who, like her sister Virginia, was a writer, not a novelist, but a literary historian. In fact, the whole family was very verbal, except for Vanessa. And in fact, in the section that I'm going to read first, there's this real sense of the way she struggles with language. She had a reputation for getting cliches wrong, you know, phrases that everyone knew she would confuse, you know, and seem to be rather dense about it. And so she was sort of famous for her malaprops. August 10th, 1941. Words fail me again. Duncan catching me this time in my confusion. Water over the bridge. Yesterday's slip, a long worm that has no turning. Never mind, I'd smile when Virginia teased, words played a kind of hide-and-go-seek with me. She writes, I paint, I'd say. How else could we keep ourselves separate? Still, it stung. Whatever the game or sport, Virginia was always the quickest. Those warm evenings at St. Ives when she vanished into the mazy reaches of the yard before I had finished counting, outdistancing Toby and Adrian, who were always fairly easy to find, their awkward boy limbs jutting out from the trunk of some tree. I was still trying to catch her long after I could see. Later, when our father asked, hadn't we heard him calling us to come in? Didn't we know how late it had gotten? I was the only one who found my voice and confessed, the Stephen without the blessing of a lexicon under her tongue. I should say before I read the next section that after Vanessa's mother died and after her half-sister Stella, who I don't think I mentioned before, died, it fell to Vanessa as the oldest daughter to run this Victorian household. And part of what was involved was keeping the household accounts, and she had to report to her father on a weekly basis just how the money that he had allowed her was spent. And if she was ever over, it threw him into a rage, and he was sure that they were going to be going to the poorhouse, which was impossible. They were sort of, you know, intellectual kind of upper middle class family with not a lot of money, but quite comfortable. And so in this section, I'm describing an encounter that she, as many that she had on Wednesday afternoons when she had to account to her father for how the money was spent. September 19th, 1941. Wednesday morning, I remember. The household accounts due. The weeks I was 10, 12 pounds over. I could hardly swallow my lunch, fearing the afternoon's inquisition. The dark room at the top of the house where my father would wait in his rocker, writing. mother, dead then 2 years, was useless. As I climbed the stairs, I found Virginia on the second landing, as always, father's favorite, divided. In the room, he slammed his fist against the book, shouting, "I am ruined. Have you no pity standing there like a block of stone?" And as skillfully as the best models at the academy, I did not blink, did not stretch a limb. By picturing a scene, I learned I could leave it. Father, the figure before him barely breathing, velvet curtains against the light. I am drawing Vanessa still, now as then, determined not to alter a feature in my rendering. The arms ending at her waist in one quiet fist. Eyes marooned in that resolute face, she could be at sea. So far is she from her father, who, in his rocking, gets smaller and smaller. His voice fading away until it makes no difference if his mouth still moves. She can no longer hear what he is saying. The last section that I'm going to read from this longer poem really concerns the struggle that went on all of her life for Vanessa to somehow balance the pursuit of her art, painting, and the obligations of her mothering. She had three children whom she essentially raised on her own. And so finding time to paint was always difficult. This, of course, another issue of competition, was not the problem for her sister Virginia Woolf, who didn't have children and who essentially was cared for merely as a child by her husband Leonard. Much of my poem really concerns this struggle, and in this particular section, again, Vanessa is thinking about her sister, who she says never knew it, that is, never knew the tension that came for Vanessa in somehow trying to be both artist and mother. November 15th, 1941. She never knew it, the lying down and rising up. Having no children, how could she have understood the habit of giving? Broken in those spotty moments when, finally alone, without daughter or sons, my brush was the only tongue moving. Curves and hollows, deep shadows and silver edges. In the quiet, even the tiresome coal scuttle assumes a secret life. Sometimes beneath the touchable surface, mine reveals itself. Cobalt blue beneath the body's apparent blush. Interlocking circles, intersecting lines. It's a particular window. North light, everyone else is sleeping. Look and look, and you can leave the material world for a vanishing point. Moving away from England, southern England, and Vanessa Bell and Virginia Woolf into my own territory where I probably feel more comfortable. I'm going to read a poem which is also deals with being a mother, and it also has something to do with cicadas. Growing up, I had a brother who, from the time that he was in third grade, wanted to be an entomologist, and he caught things and mounted moths and butterflies, and there was carbon tetrachloride in the house. And anyway, somehow, even though I thought I hated him and this disgusting pursuit at the time, I found that I did learn something about bugs, as I call them. And And cicadas have always really fascinated me, and probably most of you know all this, but it probably helps to in understanding the poem to think about how cicadas are underground for years and years as larvae, and then somehow find their way above ground and generally and shed their husks and hang out in the trees most of the summer and make this great racket. This the sound that's very difficult to describe, I think. I try. This poem is written in six short parts. Autumn, a sequence. More this year than ever before, on siding, porch rail, oak limb, and sill, evidence like a cell door standing open, or clothing dropped in haste to the floor. After the shedding of husks, cicadas sound the high note, the fire friction makes of brittle kindling. The moment we wait for, when, burning, we extinguish the given, praise ash. My son celebrated his 15th birthday at his best friend's funeral. The preacher, praising the spirit risen from the body crumpled in the back of a pickup. No blame for the drunk teenager driving. Why grieve, he sang. God has taken Tom from us that you, his friends, might be saved. And my son, hearing nothing but the white noise of his grief in that summer's heat, turned away from us all, leaving the preacher in his church demanding the saved raise their hands, leaving me little better than that preacher calling him home. That long winter underground, how do they climb? Spiraling slowly upward or side to side, sweeping the interminable dirt. Sometimes I imagine it's like learning to swim, kicking first to rise, a leaf catching an updraft, then sinking down into earth, water or air, still young, without wings. Buzz. It's all buzz and lust, the cicada's hoax, or at dusk, another octave of yearning, the dull hunger of hope. Let the geode open to quartz, moon show its hand, then sleep, sleep, newborn August child crying at the breast, child nothing could calm. One day, another, and summer is gone. Though they haven't yet fallen, the green leaves of the cottonwood tree turn over, exposing their silver. My son visits Tom's grave. By Labor Day, not only do the translucent brown husks cling to the sides of our house, we find their summer bodies on their backs, iridescent green, and in the days cleansed of their sawing, I hear his voice, which, after a year, has regained its sweetness, its registers deepened. I despair of metaphor. The carpenter ants that for a time made sawdust of our walls, the mayfly ephemera, a glitter in our sobering continuum, cricket, field mouse, and bird song, season upon season. Still, this is the worry love has become. Nights, as if underground, mothers dream of their sons. Wait for a sign, light, light years away to reach them. Can people hear me way back there? You look so far away. I can't imagine my voice is reaching you. I think I'm going to read a poem from my first book, Forms of Conversion. I haven't read in a long time, so it should be fun for me. The title is Amaki, a scene from the tale of Genji. And Amaki were 14th century and earlier scrolls, Japanese scrolls, with both words and images. And the particular one I'm referring to here is one scene from the tale of Genji, the famous Japanese novel. And in this particular scene, there is Genji, the character of Genji, and also his lover Murasaki, who is about to die. Imaki, a scene from the tale of Genji. The roof has been blown away, so we see the interior of the room, a world of layered blues, browns, and greens from above, as the moon would or the hovering did. The steeply angled walls seem to converge on Genji, who sits back to us on the floor. He might be serene, robed in pale brown, except for the black hat which bears him down like a stone. His lover, Murasaki, beautiful and barren according to the story, is a sleeve half concealing a face, a kimono at rest. The space between them is growing. Outside, the garden is silver and stormy. Wind agitates the autumn grass. The tall blades are bending and breaking one over the other. And finally, it is the sorrow in the grass that shows us Murasaki is dying. For she could simply be shielding her eyes from the evening light in order to sleep. And Genji could be reading before turning in, as we do without thinking. You can tell so little of their suffering by their faces. They could belong to anyone, being featureless, except for the inked brows, the artist's last strokes over color, in a scene from a scroll meant to be held in your hands. Enough of death. Read something sort of silly. This is a poem that someone asked me to read. It's titled Wandering Prayer. And the idea came from a novel titled The White Cutter by David Pownall. And the novel is about the art of, or craft, I guess, of medieval masonry. And I think he made this up, but I'm not sure. That is that there was a convent near Curlies in England where the women there, the nuns there, practiced this unusual thing called wandering prayer, which they sort of circled around behind the choir in the church and sang and danced their devotion to God. And so that's where I started, and I sort of take it somewhere from there. Wandering prayer. Because the world was terrible and the wild pigs in the forest real, They sketched painstaking lines of foliage on stone pillars and made of their church a forest indoors. How lissome marble became, how like the young ash trees beyond the convent wall. The English sisters strolled among the stone saplings, then devised figures and steps, ringing their handmade trees. Wandering prayer, they called their dance to banish the devils, as Jesus had the swine. Meanwhile, beyond the wall, larkspur and fern flourished among the rocks, evergreen, dust, and dung, and sometimes through the convent panes, snow fell far away. Still, better the colorless stone foliage without seasons, the sisters agreed. The pigs would run right through you if you opened the door. Sometimes, when the abbess wasn't looking, as frivolity was not allowed, the sisters would chase one another behind the altar, flapping their arms like blackbirds in their habits, faster and faster, making themselves the wind, then birds again. Caw, caw, caught, they screamed when they pinned one against a tree. How little they remembered of sacrifice and modesty then. The captured sister squealing with delight, the others squawking, dizzily turning circles around her as if this were the end of all their prayer and art. Gone to heaven, the stuck one cried out, and the game would begin again. That one is more fun to read than most of my other poems. I guess because it's narrative. It's a story. So few of mine are like that. I'm probably running out of time, I guess. I didn't look. I'll read one more poem. And this is, as the other one that I just read, is from my book, Living at the Epicenter, that, as Michael said, will be out shortly. The title of the book, Living at the Epicenter, the title poem refers to the New Madrid earthquakes of 1811 and 1812, and that's a longish poem. I think I'm going to wait to read it left bank when I do my book signing. But I have other poems in the book that concern natural disasters. There are floods, earthquakes, all manner of ways in which nature can sort of come up and change our lives, let alone people. That happens too in the book. But this is actually the last poem in the book, and it's also an earthquake poem. It's titled Fault Line, and it's not about New Madrid. It's about another earthquake that occurred several years ago in Southern California. I'd been working on the book, and I'd done research to find out what happened at New Madrid, and I'd never experienced an earthquake. And so this records something like my experience of a relatively minor, my husband would disagree with me, but only one person died, as opposed to many, many, earthquake in Southern California. And I was several hundred miles from that quake, and it was very odd for me because since I'd been writing about the catastrophic way in which the New Madrid quakes affected the river and parts of Missouri and beyond, it was amazingly gentle and calm. I was surprised. Fault line. It wasn't at all what she had imagined, this gentle rocking, as if she'd been awakened at sea, the boat she found herself in at ease in the waves, a swallow dipping on currents of air, darker than the still dark morning. Elsewhere, the earth is riven. At the epicenter, The wounded spill from their beds. The desert's cleaved along a fault, every beautiful surface masking its death. But more than that, it's the slipperiness of things, what you thought you could trust coming up like a coin on the other side. The way some words are reversible, like cleave or close, close. Out of context, how would you know how to say it? And even here, before dawn, lying next to her lover several hundred miles from the quake, she's not sure which part of speech applies. His eyes, sometimes green, sometimes blue, her mind with him, then in another season, watching the leaves turn to wine. Where is it written that intimacy must end? Outside, oleander comes alive in the courtyard, desert willow, tamarisk, while within, where they lie, the snowy motes lift in the first light, lift and fall, fall where they will, shimmering.